Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today we're diving into the fascinating world of Viking runes.
And not just superficially, like you might know from movies. Runes are far more than just an ancient alphabet. They're a writing system of the Germanic tribes that the Vikings didn't invent, but certainly made extensive use of.
What fascinated me from the very start, in our Latin alphabet, at least nowadays, with runes it's, well, more layered than that.
That's exactly the crux of it. Take the rune Fehu, the first rune in the so-called Elder Futhark. It represents the F sound, sure, but at the same time it also means cattle and, by extension, movable wealth. Or Urus, the second rune, the U sound, but also Aurochs, and thus primal strength.
So each symbol is simultaneously a letter and a symbol with its own meaning. That's like...
like if our letter A didn't just stand for the A sound, but also represented beginning or departure. Every single character carries an additional layer of meaning.
And that's what makes runes so special. The Germanic tribes didn't just use them for communication, but also for ritual purposes, magical practices.
This is the threefold function we'll be discussing today. First, communication. Purely practical things like conveying messages, carving names onto weapons, that sort of thing. Second, rituals. Religious practices where runes played a central role. And third, symbolism. The deeper layer of meaning in each individual rune.
Although, to be fair, the magical component is often overemphasized, isn't it?
Yes, you're right about that. Archaeologically, we mainly find practical inscriptions, ownership marks, names, memorial stones. The mystical charge was partly added later, but...
but a certain layer of meaning did develop over time. Much of what we know comes from later rune poems. But that's precisely what sets runes apart from our alphabet.
Absolutely. And today we'll also talk about the different runic alphabets. The Elder Futhark with its 24 characters, the Younger Futhark, which, interestingly, only has 16 runes.
Fewer characters for more sounds.
Exactly. A simplification that reflects linguistic changes. And then there's the Anglo-Saxon Futhark, with up to 33 runes. So, three different systems that evolved over centuries.
And the everyday use. That's what I find particularly fascinating. Rune stones as memorials. Runes on weapons. On jewelry.
We'll go into that in detail. Also, the divination practices associated with runes. Tacitus describes casting lots with marked wooden sticks. But he only speaks of signs, not explicitly of runes. And there's no archaeological evidence from the Viking Age for this either.
Though we need to be careful about what's historically documented versus modern interpretation.
Right. Today we're trying to separate the facts from the myths. And at the end we'll also look at why runes continue to hold such fascination today. In pop culture, in books, films, games, they're everywhere.
Then let's dive into this world. Let's start with the origins, the Germanic roots.
That's exactly where we'll begin. The history of runes starts long before the Viking Age.
You just mentioned these three major systems, the Elder Futhark, Younger Futhark, and the Anglo-Saxon Futhark. Let's take a closer look at them, because their development ran partly in parallel, but in completely different directions.
That's the paradox, isn't it? In Scandinavia, they simplified. In England, they expanded. At the same time.
Let's start at the beginning. The Elderfutag is the oldest known runic alphabet, used from roughly the 2nd to the 8th century AD. 24 runes that we find on archaeological discoveries throughout Northern Europe.
And some of these finds are remarkably old. The Svingerid runestone in Norway, only discovered in 2021, is dated to somewhere between the 1st and 3rd century. It's currently considered the oldest runic inscription on stone anywhere in the world.
Stones, weapons, jewelry, combs, brooches. We encounter runes on all kinds of different objects.
Although, to be fair, most early inscriptions are short. Names, ownership marks, sometimes ritual formulas. No lengthy texts.
And then, from the 8th century onwards, the younger Futhark comes into play. It's often seen as a paradox, because they reduced the system from 24 to just 16 runes.
Even though the language was simultaneously
becoming more complex, more sounds, more vowels, it seems illogical at first.
So how did they solve that?
One rune suddenly had to cover multiple sounds. That made reading harder, but writing, well, at least more compact. Fewer characters to learn, faster to carve.
And the younger Futhark is what we see on the great Scandinavian runestones. Most of those date from this later period.
There were even two variants within the younger Futhark. The long branch runes for monumental inscriptions and the
short twig runes for everyday use. Regional differences within Scandinavia.
Both variants appear on stones and everyday objects. It was mainly a matter of region and time period. Long branch, more in Denmark. Short twig, more in Sweden and Norway.
And in England at the same time?
There, the development went in the opposite direction. The Anglo-Saxon Futhark expanded the system to up to 33 runes. The Anglo-Saxon dialects had different sounds, different linguistic features.
So instead of using one rune for multiple sounds,
they invented a new rune for each new sound, a completely different approach.
The Anglo-Saxon Futhark was used until the 11th century?
Until the Latin alphabet finally took over. But for several centuries, both systems existed side by side.
What excites me, these parallel developments show how adaptable the runic system was. Not a rigid alphabet, but a living system that evolved alongside the languages.
The runes essentially migrated with the people. When the Anglo-Saxons came to Britain, they brought their runes with them and developed them further. In Scandinavia, they stuck with the system, but simplified it for practical use.
And that also explains why decipherment is so complex. You always need to know which runic alphabet, which region, which
time period. A younger Futhark character can have a completely different phonetic value than the corresponding elder Futhark character.
For runologists, it's real detective work.
Especially with damaged or worn inscriptions. That's why well-preserved finds are so valuable. There are thousands of Scandinavian runestones, an incredible wealth of sources.
Each individual stone is a small window into the past, with regional variants, linguistic peculiarities, sometimes even spelling mistakes.
So, the Vikings didn't always write perfectly either.
That's what makes the finds so vivid. You see real people at work, not abstract scholars.
Elder Futhark, Younger Futhark, Anglo-Saxon Futhark. Three expressions of the same basic idea. Adapted to time, place and language. It shows how organically writing develops. Not designed on a drawing board, but grown with the people who used it.
Now it gets really interesting. Runes weren't just a writing system. Each individual character carried its own meaning. Concepts from nature, from mythology, from daily life.
And that makes interpretation so multifaceted. When someone carved a rune onto a weapon or a stone, it wasn't simply a letter. A symbolic dimension could often resonate as well, although many inscriptions are also purely practical.
Take the runestones. They're our most important sources, period. Thousands of them, especially in Sweden, around 3,000 in Sweden alone. And most followed a similar pattern, you could say.
Simple memorial formulas, mostly, right?
Yes, often following the pattern, A raised this stone for B. But then there are the exceptions, and those are...
Spectacular! The Rökstone in Sweden, for example, with around 760 runic characters on both sides. The longest known inscription of all.
It tells actual stories, mentions heroic figures, possibly even Theodoric the Great. Myths and commemorative culture woven into a single stone.
And then the Jelling stones in Denmark? The larger one is sometimes called Denmark's birth certificate. King Harald Bluetooth had it erected. The smaller one was made by his father Gorm.
The inscription is a pure political statement. Essentially, Harald, who won all of Denmark and made the Danes Christian. You can see how runes were also used for propaganda.
So, far more than just grave markers. Demonstrations of power, religious change, all carved in stone.
And then the weapons. That's where it gets interesting, because many people think Viking weapons were covered in magical runic formulas.
Is that actually true?
The archaeological reality is more sobering. Runic inscriptions on weapons were actually quite rare. And when they did appear, they were usually practical. Owners' names, smith's marks. The famous Ulfbert swords, for example, don't bear runes at all, but Latin letters.
Ah, I see. So with Ulfbert, more of a quality mark than a magic spell.
You could put it that way. That doesn't mean protective formulas didn't exist. The Vikings certainly believed that certain symbols could bestow power, but...
But the idea that every sword was covered in magical runes is more pop culture than archaeology.
With jewelry, it's a different story. Pendants, amulets, brooches, these were often decorated with runes. The symbolic protective function played a bigger role there.
And in everyday life, runes were also used quite mundanely. Simple messages, ownership marks. In Bergen, hundreds of runic inscriptions on wooden sticks have been found, some containing quite ordinary communications, though most of these date from the later Middle Ages, so after the Viking period.
The famous example, love messages, trade notes, even, well, doodles from boredom. The Vikings were very human in that way.
I find that remarkable. It shows that runes were truly present in all areas of life, not just for the monumental, but also for the mundane.
That's the heart of the matter. They were simultaneously sacred and profane, ritualistic and practical. A flexible system that adapted to the situation at hand.
And today we see something similar. In reenactment, people use runes on their equipment, sometimes authentically reconstructed, sometimes...
more inspired. Though it has to be said, when someone today engraves their name in runes on a sword, they're essentially doing exactly what a Viking could have done.
So the tradition lives on. Even though we now know that the mystical charge is often modern interpretation.
That's an important point. The meanings we attribute to runes are partly historically documented, partly later attributions. You have to be careful about what you take at face value.
Now we come to a topic where particular caution is needed. The magical dimension of runes. And I deliberately say caution because here a lot of myth and very little verified history come together.
Exactly. While belief in the magical powers is documented, Our knowledge of the actual practices is very fragmentary.
The sources?
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
Mainly later texts. The Edda poems, the sagas. These were mostly written down in the 13th century, centuries after the actual Viking Age. Much of it has already been filtered through Christian transmission.
So when we talk about rune oracles, casting rune staves and
interpreting the patterns, we're reconstructing from fragments. The Tacitus passage we mentioned earlier from the Germania, he describes how Germanic tribes cast wooden sticks marked with symbols. But whether those were runes remains disputed.
So no clear instructions on how it worked.
The idea that there was a fixed system, each rune means X, and if it falls this way, it means Y, that's more modern interpretation.
And this is precisely where the difference lies between historical practice and what passes for rune esotericism today. Modern rune oracle systems emerged in the 20th century, often inspired by tarot traditions.
They have their own value for people who practice them, but they shouldn't be confused with Viking-era practice.
What we do find more often are protective formulas, carved on amulets, on personal objects. The magical intention is plausible, even if much remains interpretation.
There were certain formulas that appear repeatedly. ALU is a well-known one, appearing on many objects. What exactly it meant, runologists still debate to this day. Protective formula? Ritual exclamation? We don't know for certain.
But the intention was obviously magical?
The intention was to bestow protection or power on the bearer. We can deduce that from the context. Amulets, weapons, objects worn on the body.
Basically similar to a lucky charm today. You believe it helps.
With the difference that the Vikings lived in a worldview where such powers were part of reality. No separation between natural and supernatural.
And healing runes? Were those supposed to help with illnesses?
It's documented that certain runes were associated with healing properties. But again, we don't have recipe books from the Viking Age. Much comes from later Icelandic magic books, like the famous Galdrabók.
Those are truly fascinating. But that's early modern period, 17th century, not the Viking Age.
The problem is, 19th century romanticism created an image that persists stubbornly. Mystical rune masters, secret knowledge, connection to cosmic forces.
And the modern esoteric scene picked that up and developed it further.
That's not inherently bad. It shows that fascination with runes is alive and well. You just need to know what's historically verifiable and what's modern invention.
So, in summary, the Vikings believed in the power of runes, used them for protection and ritual. But the details, the specific practices, we only know those fragmentarily.
And that makes it frustrating for historians, but also fascinating. Every new find can expand our understanding.
What fascinates me, time and again, runes are a mirror of the society that used them. In the inscriptions, we see Viking values, their notions of honor, family, bravery.
And that across centuries. The runestones tell of trading journeys to Byzantium, of battles, of inheritances, concrete life stories carved into stone.
And today? Runes have arrived everywhere in pop culture.
Absolutely. Tolkien studied runes extensively. For the map in The Hobbit, he directly used the Anglo-Saxon Futhorc, and his dwarven alphabet, Kurth, was then inspired by it. He was a philologist, after all. He knew exactly what he was doing.
Video games, films, series. In God of War, Norse runes play a central role. In Assassin's Creed Valhalla, of course. And in Vikings...
You constantly see runic inscriptions, even if they are not always historically accurate.
That's almost beside the point. What matters is that the fascination lives on.
And that people become interested in history through it. Many come to the historical sources via pop culture.
For anyone who now feels inspired to delve deeper into runes, getting started isn't that difficult. It helps to familiarize yourself with one runic alphabet first, the Eldafuthag, for example.
The practical exercises are important. Drawing runes, writing them, the tactile...
Experience. You understand the symbols much better when you carve or draw them yourself.
There are good introductory books available, including in English. The runic alphabets are manageable. 24 characters in the Eldafuthag. That's doable.
And don't be put off by the esoteric literature. They're serious runology based on archaeology and linguistics.
The trick is to distinguish between the two. Historical research on one hand, modern reception on the other. Both have their place, but you should know which is which.
What do you think? Why do runes still exert such a pull today?
I think it's this combination. A writing system that was simultaneously a means of communication, a ritual tool, and a symbolic language. Our alphabet doesn't have this complexity.
Each rune is like a little concentrate of meaning. Not just a sound, but an entire concept in a single symbol.
And they connect us with people who lived over 1,000 years ago. When we read a runestone, we hear their voices. Fathers mourning their sons. Merchants proud of their journeys. Warriors who wanted to be honored.
Runes really are, as we said earlier, a window into the past. And at the same time, remarkably alive in the present.
And with that, we've reached the end of today's episode. I hope we were able to bring the fascination of Viking runes a bit closer to you.
For those who want to learn more, at battlemerchant.com, and especially in the blog there, you'll find plenty of other topics about history, Vikings, and everything that goes with it.
It's worth checking out. And if you have questions or topic suggestions for future episodes, let us know.
Until next time.
Take care.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.